For more than a decade, Governor State University hasn't had any state funding to repair old buildings, even a crumbling roof. Here's President Elaine Maimon.
In my 11 years as a president, I haven't seen any money for repairs. We've been told loud and clear, if there's no state budget by May 31st, we're not going to have that avenue. So there has to be a state budget.
We check in with Brian Mackey on how budget negotiations are going. Plus, how do you get kids excited about science? MJ Mouton did it by writing a rhyming children's book about the physicist Richard Feynman.
I would read science books to my kids because I wanted them to have an understanding of science. And what I learned was most science books are just facts. I wanted to make a book that a kid's going to go pick up off the shelf again. So they're bedtime stories, and we sneak the science.
But first, a new bill in Springfield that would limit so-called golden parachutes for state executives. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. We'll get started right after the latest news. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Illinois has been in financial trouble for a while. Even with tax hikes, we've got a huge budget deficit, cuts to social services and public universities. And like many other Illinois universities, in June of last year, Northern Illinois University didn't have much wiggle room when it came to spending. But that didn't stop the state from handing out a severance package of more than $600,000 to former President Doug Baker when he retired early after being accused of improper spending on his watch. The so-called golden parachute, that's the name that's been given for when a high-ranking individual receives an enormous severance package after leaving a job earlier than intended, usually, but not always, under cloudy circumstances. Last week, Democratic Senator Tom Cullerton introduced Senate Bill 3604, otherwise known as the Government Severance Pay Act, which would limit these so-called golden parachutes. To learn more about the bill, we're joined on the line now by Senate Cullerton. He represents Illinois' 23rd District, which includes the Chicago suburbs such of Addison and Villa Park in northern DuPage County. Senator Cullerton, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you very much. Appreciate being on.
I'm also joined on the line by Madeline Dubeck, the Policy and Engagement Director for the Better Government Association, which has been doing some reporting on this. Madeline, welcome back to the 21st.
Thank you, Nyla.
Madeline, can I start with you? We heard one example. This is based on some investigative reporting the BGA has also been doing, looking at these payouts. I wonder if you could define, though, what how the BGA is looking at what golden parachutes are.
Well, you know, I think we are just generally coming at it from a citizen taxpayer point of view and wanted to try to quantify and put in context how frequently this has been happening. And so we went out and collected as many examples as we could find last fall and actually found 9 of them that added up to more than $5 million. There have been instances specifically at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign with, in 2009, Chancellor Richard Herman. Again, in 2012 with Michael Hogan, former president, with Phyllis Wise in 2013, she got $663,000 to go away. There's example after example. It doesn't just happen at the university level. It happened at Metra with the former CEO, Alex Clifford. It's happening as we speak. There's an instance in Des Plaines Elementary District 62, where a superintendent of that district was accused of sexual harassment, and he was given $127,000 to go away. There's an example in the northern suburbs of Vernon Hills, I believe it is, with the city manager, or the village manager, being asked to go away, and there's been very little explanation as to what's going on there, but he was given a six-figure severance. And so keeping in mind the cost to taxpayers and the frustration that they have over this, we worked with Senator Cullerton to introduce this legislation that I think would make it very simple and clean for all government bodies and kind of take the negotiating and guesswork out of this for them, but Senator Cullerton can tell you more about that.
Yeah, Senator Cullerton, can you give us a little bit more details on what you're proposing?
So working with the BGA has been fantastic because they're a great group to bring data forward and help. as we start getting initiatives to get our state back on the financial path that we want to be on. What we found is through the data they compiled and sort of in my former role as a village president, that I saw contracts written for top executives when they bring them in, whether it be a school superintendent, a village manager, a chancellor at a university, and are given large contracts. But on top of those large contracts, they contend that they also needed to give 2 years of severance if by chance they get fired from that job or they decide not to renew a contract. Nowhere else does that happen. That is not happening in private sector. Nobody wants to run their business that way. Nobody wants to make their moves that way. So what we did is we obviously we still want to maintain and attract great talent. But if you look at the positions that this would qualify for, people want those jobs. And they don't want them because of a severance package. Nobody's getting a job as a village manager and desiring to move up the ladder and take full responsibility for a village or a full responsibility for a university so that one day they can get a great severance package. They're doing it because it's a great job and it's a great opportunity. So we're eliminating the opportunity for these exorbitant payouts and packages that are being written into contracts before people are even hired.
And to that end, Madeline, is it because it's written in the contract, I imagine the state has to end up paying out these things regardless of the circumstances of how the person separates from the state. Is that correct?
Well, I think in some instances that is probably the case. I think in other instances, trustees at various levels of government frequently are, when they have a situation where something maybe isn't so clear cut or there's a negotiation going on, a public executive hires an attorney, the board involved has their own attorney, there's threat of litigation, and that's probably the start of how these things escalate. And we're trying to, you know, tackle that problem and make it clear and simple for everybody. And this legislation that Senator Cullerton has proposed is modeled after similar legislation in Florida that would just kind of put a very clean limit and say you cannot receive more than 5 months' salary in a case where you're going to get some severance.
That's Madeline Dubik. She's a policy and civic engagement director of the Better Government Association. The nonpartisan Citizen Watch, Civic Watchdog Group has been reporting on this issue of golden parachutes. Senator Tom Cullerton's also on the line with us. Senator Cullerton, how does Illinois compare? We just heard Madeline say this is modeled after legislation in Florida. What does it look like for surrounding states? Do they have laws like this on the books? Where does Illinois stand?
So I can tell you from on a university standpoint, this goes on in other states. I was put into an article about a year ago, year and a half, when I spoke out against the chancellor of U of I, who was under a 5-year contract. She was deciding she wanted to resign because the university was under multiple lawsuits. The contract said she had to get $500,000 when she fulfilled all 5 years. The board was going to give her $400,000 because she did 4 years, even though she was leaving under a cloud. And from what I found out from the interview was that this is going on in Pennsylvania. This has happened in Delaware. This has happened in California. These golden parachutes are not just prone to Illinois. So as far as what other states and how many other states are really going after this problem, I don't think as many are doing it that should be doing it. When you have the Washington papers talking about this, and that becomes a problem. And one of the bigger pieces of this puzzle as well is because you have one payout, it paints all the other employees that are government employees in an incredibly bad light as well. Because people in their brain go, see, they're crooks. And it's all because one person did something. And now everybody else gets painted in that vein. And we have great employees in this state, but every time a golden parachute comes out, people look at that and think that's the norm for everybody.
And Senator Cullerton, just to be clear, taxpayers are bearing the financial burden of these payouts, correct?
Yes. Yes. It's coming out of whatever government entity it is, it's coming out of that government entity's pocketbook. So at the colleges, it's coming directly out of the college funds that the state takes care of. For local municipalities, that's whenever they do that for a village administrator, that comes out of your property taxes. That's how the funding for local municipalities is done. They get some from the state and the rest from property taxes and sales tax. So that's coming directly out of there.
And Senator Cullerton, what kind of support have you had so far as you've introduced this?
So far, it's been great. And I will say the BGA is fantastic. Besides being such good partners with helping compile data, they're truly big advocates for what they bring forward and for better government. So they are incredibly helpful in rallying support around other colleagues, making sure the message gets out, making sure we're getting good traction for the bill. So we're finding a lot of support throughout, and we've had newspapers bringing it up and putting it forward.
Right. And I wonder, Madeline, as we think about this, are there other policy changes you think should be made that could also help limit these excessive payouts?
I think this is a terrific first step, and we cannot thank Senator Cullerton enough for his leadership in putting this forward and really working the legislation with us. He's been a terrific advocate, and I think that it's something that taxpayers will certainly appreciate if we can get it done. I do know that there are some other similar bills out there in this sort of the ongoing Me Too movement that address the transparency of some of these payouts and making sure that they are out there and that citizens and taxpayers are aware of them, the extent of them, the reason for them, and that there's some notification of an agreement before it is approved by a particular government body.
As it stands now, what does transparency look like? You mentioned Florida earlier. Certainly Illinois' government laws are not as transparent in the way that the Illinois government operates compared to Florida's government and the Sunshine Laws. What, Madeline, would you like to see with transparency when it comes to how we learn about different units of government throughout Illinois, whether it's the state government or municipalities decide the amount of the payment for these severance packages?
Well, I think anytime you're talking about spending taxpayer dollars, taxpayers deserve to know as much as possible, but there's always a balancing act that needs to occur with the people involved. I know in the situation in Des Plaines, there were several allegations of sexual harassment from some comments that people were saying the superintendent there made. But none of the employees who reported that concern were willing to come forward and be publicly named. And so, you know, you're obviously also dealing with that superintendent's reputation and his ability to work, you know, going forward. And so there's always a balancing act that has to occur. But, you know, certainly the Better Government Association is always going to try to come down in favor of more transparency and debate and discussion within reason before any sort of agreement is reached.
Senator Cullerton, it certainly seems reasonable, all of these things that you're talking about. I wonder, though, I heard you say that it sounds like you were anticipating counter proposals to this, saying this won't make Illinois any less competitive. Are you hearing any concerns from your colleagues in the Senate and the House about this bill?
No, this would be a very tough bill to oppose. This would be an incredibly tough bill for anybody to really sort of push against. There may be people who push behind the scenes that they're not fans of the bill, but publicly, I would be, if I saw somebody publicly oppose it and put their name out there that says, no, these are good things that need to keep occurring, I would be amazed.
And so that said, what's the time frame of what you're doing with this? Where are you hoping to, the bill's bidding committee, am I correct?
So the bill is, the bill was filed. We are more than likely going to have committee next week, and we'll just move it through the process. The goal is to get it through both chambers by May 31st, which I see us being able to do very easily. Well, not very easily. Springfield sometimes is not very easy, but we'll be able to get it through both chambers before May 31st.
That's the Government Severance Pay Act. Speaking of May 31st, later in the hour, we are going to be talking about that budget deadline that's looming on May 31st with Illinois Public Radio's Brian Mackey. Right now, I want to thank Senator Tom Cullerton. He represents Illinois' 23rd District, Northern DuPage County. Madeline Dubeck has been with us as well, Policy and Civic Engagement Director for the BGA. Senator Madeline, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Milo. Thank you, Senator.
Up, we're going to be speaking to Aurora, Illinois-based children's book author MJ Mouton about a new book he wrote about one of the world's greatest physicists, Richard Feynman. It's for kids, and the book's called Richie Doodles, The Brilliance of a Young Richard Feynman. Stay tuned. That conversation's coming up just after the break. You're listening to The 21st. Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Richard Feynman was one of the world's greatest physicists. He was born in 1918 in New York and won the Nobel Prize in 1965. He's known in the scientific community for figuring out how to visually map out the math that determines how subatomic particles behave. But it's more than that. Feynman is remembered for his passion, for his ability to describe complex physics to everyday people, and just for having a lot of fun exploring science throughout his entire life. So perhaps it's fitting that Aurora, Illinois-based children's book author MJ Mouton wrote a new book about what Richard Feynman was like as a kid. It's called Richie Doodles, The Brilliance of a Young Richard Feynman. MJ, welcome to The 21st. Thanks for being here with me.
Pretty awesome to be here.
Why Richard Feynman out of all of the scientists? This is I should mention, it's not the first book you've done in this Tiny Thinker series, but it's the most recent one.
No, it's the one that our publishers wanted to put next. But I have 40 what I consider good stories that I wrote for my daughters probably about 7 years ago. There's actually about 60 stories in total, but 20 of them need a lot of work. And so the reason I wrote the Richard Feynman story was not necessarily because he's a physicist, but he's pretty much an awesome example of somebody who thinks outside the box, somebody who looks at things differently, and somebody who was a great communicator of science. And what he did was he was able to simplify something that was extremely complex and be able to share that with the layman person. So I like the fact of the Richard Feynman book coming out second, because I think I tried to take it to another level, to take it down to a child. So often, scientists don't have the abilities to communicate with the general public, and it takes science communicators to convey complex things. And so that's what the Tiny Thinkers books do. They portray complex ideas, but to a kid who's between 4 and 6 years old, even though the books are geared for kids 1 through 8, you know, if parents read it, Richard Feynman did so much, and I'm proud that it's the second book because it conveys that message. Look at things from a different point of view, from a different perspective, and you can teach complex things to kids. They can do it.
How did you learn about, what research did you do into his life?
Richard Feynman has a ton of lectures that are out there that you can listen to and learn about the science of it, but there's a ton of documentaries as well. The BBC did a fantastic documentary on Richard Feynman, and then he wrote his own book, Surely You're Joking, and several other books. So for the most part, it comes from reading books about Richard Feynman and seeing the documentaries. Before I wrote any of the books, I used documentaries on my drive to and from work, and I learned, for the most part, word for word, every ounce of that documentary. I read what I can, and then when it's time to sit down and write a story, it comes naturally and it becomes easy. I don't typically write about a person's life. I write about an inspiring moment in that scientist's young life that made them go on to be the person that they are.
And what do you think that moment was for Richard Feynman?
His relationship with his dad. His relationship with his dad was, if he asked a question, his dad would, for the most part, make him look for an answer himself, in a sense. So Richard Feynman can ask a question like, hey, Dad, I'm pulling this wagon, and when I stop, the ball keeps moving. And his dad explains inertia. So he had this father who was able to explain stuff. Now, he was a gifted mind. He won, I think, the New York math competition. And so he was already a brilliant mind. But his father nurtured his brilliance by challenging him in a lot of different ways. And that way, a lot of those ways was explaining to him, you can know the name of something, but if you don't know how it works, you know nothing about it. And he even talks about that in those documentaries, of how those influences were, the way his dad spoke with him and the way his dad interacted with him was a huge part in how he looked at things.
I'm speaking with Aurora-based children's book author M.J. Mouton. His most recent book is called Richie Doodles, and it's about the physicist Richard Feynman. And you mentioned that for Richard Feynman, it was his dad who nurtured him and inspired him. You started writing all of these stories for your daughters. Are you hoping that more children will become interested in science just reading these stories about these great minds?
Absolutely. So I wrote these stories for my daughters for a certain reason, but I wanted to get them published for a different reason. There's people who never know academic heroes, and often they don't know those academic heroes until they get a little bit older. So we're in the Chicago area. If you go into, say, South Chicago, into economically depressed area, urban area, and you ask any kid out there, who is Jackie Robinson? Every kid will be able to tell you who Jackie Robinson was because he was a barrier breaker in sports. But if you would ask him, say, who is Percy Julian? Percy Julian was possibly the greatest chemist that America has ever produced. He was born in Birmingham, Alabama, but his labs and his life mostly happened up here in Oak Park in the Chicago area. Percy Julian synthesized the natural drugs that are in plants. And so he first started off with stigmasterol and these drugs that could help women after giving birth. But later on, it was things like cortisone and stuff. This guy is America's greatest chemist, and no one knows his name. So when he was a child, well, he got his start by seeing a guy named St. Elmo Brady, and St. Elmo Brady was the first chemist ever in America. And Percy Julian said, if Elmo Brady can do it, so can I. And so hopefully by putting a lot of these scientists out there, that some other kid can look at it and say, hey, if Percy Julian did it, so can I. If Marie Curie did it, so can I. If Carl Sagan did it, so can I. And they need to be introduced at a young age. I didn't realize until I was much older in life my love for science, because where I grew up, I didn't have any inspiration in that world. And then
that was in southern Louisiana?
That was in southern Louisiana. And it's a shame that that doesn't happen in southern Louisiana, because we have one of the most diverse ecosystems in the entire country, yet we have people who should be biologists, who should, you know, be in those scientific fields, and we're importing them when we should be producing them. And a lot of it is you're not taught to look beyond your rural community at what your potential is. So if you don't get to move away, if you don't get to see your potential, you'll just stay rurally anchored to your area. And some of our most brilliant people who could be a mechanical engineer is a mechanic. The girls who go on to be nurses or school teachers, they have so much more potential, but their rural surroundings never offered anything other than what they could see as a viable option to stay where they're at and to live a decent life. But their potential is so much more. So they need to be introduced to people. And it doesn't even have to be a scientist. You'll see in life, if you have an aunt or an uncle who is the first to finish college, you'll see the nieces and nephews finish college as well. And so you need to have a hero. And a lot of places there aren't heroes, and I hope those books can provide one or two.
My guest is children's book author MJ Mouton about his recent book in the Tiny Thinker series. They're books for children, and he's saying ages 1 to 8. His first book was about Charles Darwin. It was called Charlie and the Tortoise. This newest book is called Richie Doodles, about the life of physicist Richard Feynman. So who was the hero for you when you were a kid?
It was human beings for me, because I moved away and I started working, and I went into the environmental construction field. So now I'm a worker-type operator, labor-type worker, and then I'm getting to work around biologists, and I'm getting to work around anthropologists and stuff to that nature. So when I would see something that fascinated me, I had somebody to ask that question to that could give me a real answer. And I would guess, I would say that I had a weird introduction into finding stuff. My dad would... We grew up in South Louisiana hunting and fishing. We were looking for bullet casings because we reloaded our own ammunition to hunt and stuff to that nature. So you were always looking at the ground and finding Indian artifacts and stuff to that nature. Later on, when I got into the atmosphere where I worked, and I'm seeing not only those things, but different layers of soils and stuff to that, I had real scientists to ask questions to. And then I realized, man, I have this in my blood. Because once somebody loves something or is inspired to love something, they're going to go seek the information on their own. So in the sense of, like, I'll use my dad as an example, because we were always looking for bullets. And somebody may say, well, he never went to college, he wasn't educated. But you ask him about something that he loves, say, in that situation, his love was guns and stuff to that nature. He can tell you the make and model of every gun, the rifling of the barrel. He could tell you the spin. He could tell you all these technical and scientific aspects of what that does. And you find the same thing in mechanics. They may know thermodynamics, they just don't know the word. And so this guy is scientifically minded, he just wasn't ever inspired to take that knowledge any further. But once they love something, cars or that or something else, you seek knowledge on your own. And so if you inspire somebody to love something at a young age, they'll seek that.
What I really enjoyed about this story was about Richard Feynman was talking about how he loved to draw, and he had these doodles. And I love the story that you have in here that encourages children to just sketch and do that on their own, because it played such an important role with Richard Feynman ultimately being able to understand how subatomic particles actually move and behave.
Many of the stories are like that. In the Richard Feynman book, what I'm trying to convey is that Richard Feynman always looked for an easier way to explain something. But more in the sense of what you were just talking about, we have a guy named George Cuvier back in the 1700s whose mother taught him how to draw, and she was an artist. And they would draw the animals around the house, you know, that they could find in their yard. And he drew them with such great detail that by the time he was 17 years old, he was a professor in college, because he knew more about animals than any other person. And then he eventually grew up. His claim to fame is what he did was he improved the taxonomy of animals by, kingdom, phyla, class, order, family, genus, species. That's where he worked, because once he got into a college setting, he knew more about animals from the outside, but once he got in that college setting, he was able to learn about the animals from the inside. And his inspiration came from his mother actually teaching him to draw. And then another she's not a professional scientist, but there was one named Mary Ward, and she's the one who I most identify with. And she liked to draw the smallest of details of things, little plants, wings of insects, not the whole insects, but the smallest things. And an astronomer seen her drawing one day and told her father, you should give her a microscope so she can see things smaller. And he did that. And so she would draw things in the smallest of details. She wasn't, let's say, college educated or anything like that. Eventually, she had this book of drawings that she had done, and it's just Mary Ward's raw nature. She did that on her own. She was self-taught. She did it. She wrote. She didn't think that anybody would publish a book by an uneducated female back in that time. So she self-produced the book herself, producing 250 copies. They sold out in weeks. It went to 8 prints, and it was called The World Through a Microscope. And this is somebody who I would identify with, but she was encouraged when she was a young kid by just somebody saw potential, and she had a love for something, and she made it happen.
That said, what do you, as we think about this book, it sounds like you are hoping to inspire a whole other generation of children with this story in particular, but all the stories you're writing about.
All the stories I'm writing about. You want to inspire, but oftentimes kids aren't even exposed. And so they need some form of exposure. And I would read science books to my kids because I wanted them to have an understanding of science. And what I learned was most science books are just facts. You know, Marie Curie was born November 7th, 1867 in Poland. And you can read that book to your kid. You may get through it. They're probably going to nod off. And at nighttime, when you want to read a bedtime story, they go to the shelves. They're never going to pull that book and bring it back to you because that book is boring to them. But what they are going to bring back is Dr. Seuss. And Dr. Seuss, 10 times out of 10, they're going to come back. If you tell them to go get 3 books, they're going to, and Dr. Seuss is in the mix, they're going to come back with that Dr. Seuss book. Because it's a bedtime story, it's in rhyme form, it's entertaining, and it's colorful. So what we did, and what I did for the Tiny Thinkers books, is I made something that was in rhyme form that my kids would want to hear multiple times, and they enjoyed them. This is before they're even books. These are just stories that I have, for the most part, have memorized, and I got my daughter laying there, and I'm just saying it in rhyme form, and sometimes she adds something to it or doesn't. I wanted to make a book that a kid's going to go pick up off the shelf again. So they're bedtime stories, and we sneak the science.
That book is just out. It's called Richie Doodles, The Brilliance of a Young Richard Feynman. The author is Aurora, Illinois-based MJ Mouton. MJ, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you. It was awesome. We'll be right back.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Lawmakers have been back in session since last Monday. Many are hoping that their state house bills become law over the course of the next few weeks. But really, our General Assembly has one important job, and that's pass a budget. We know that process hasn't been very smooth in years past. Our state went 2 years without one, and during last year's session, it took an override of the governor's veto to finally break through the impasse. What will happen this time? Will there be another impasse? Will lawmakers and the governors make it work, especially this election year? Brian Mackey's been reporting on this for Illinois Public Radio in the Illinois Newsroom. Hey, Brian, welcome back to the 21st.
Hey, Nyla, how are you?
So last year at this time, we were in a pretty dire situation. We were approaching 2 years without a budget. What's the mood this time around? Is it different?
I think it is different. People, the hard vote was last year. That's when legislators voted to raise taxes. That's when 16 Republicans broke with Governor Rauner to join Democrats to raise taxes. And so that was the hard part. Now it's just a question of how you spend the money. I mean, frankly, that wasn't enough of a tax increase to make up for all the years without a budget and all the spending that Illinois is obligated to do and has obligated itself to do. For example, the Department of Corrections is looking for another $400 million some dollars this year just to meet expenses because they are still paying off bills that were incurred during the impasse. But the mood is generally better because the money is there. It's just a question of how you spend it.
Right. And you've been talking to people about how this is affecting them. And one of the people you actually talked to in your reporting was the president of Governor State University, Elaine Maiman. And she said that in 11 years, Governor State hasn't had any state funding to repair old buildings or even a crumbling roof. Here's what she told you.
In my 11 years as a president, I haven't seen any money for repairs. We've been told loud and clear if there's no state budget by May 31st, we're not going to have that avenue. So there has to be a state budget.
So president of Governor State University, Elaine Maiman, speaking to Brian Mackey, who's on the line with us right now from Springfield. Brian, what needs to happen in order for places like Governor State to get some financial relief from the state this year?
Yeah, so typically, and what she's talking about is building, right? So that requires a capital bill. Illinois hasn't had one of those since the early part of the Quinn administration. And this is something that, you know, you need a source of revenue. So you need, in the past, Illinois raised fees on license plates to pay for one capital bill. Another time, I think it was gambling expansion paid for one. But in this case, you'd need to agree on some source of money to pay for it. And you need trust because you don't parties don't want to give the other, you know, so in this case, it would be Democrats don't want to give Governor Rauner that much control over things where maybe he would only cut ribbons in Republican districts. It wouldn't authorize the projects in Democratic districts. Trust was a question during the Blagojevich administration. They had forced him to sign these memoranda of understanding, these legal agreements saying that he would follow through on the spending agreements they made. So without trust, you can't have a capital bill. Without a capital bill, you can't pay for building projects. She was saying, Elaine Maiman, the president of Governor State. She is, I think some people refer to her as the dean of the university president. She's the longest serving university president of a public university in Illinois. And she says there just has not been money. The legislature has not been able to prioritize any money for repairs, and buildings are literally crumbling. So because of that, they have to bond. They have to go to the bond market. They have to borrow money themselves. And what her financial advisors have told her, she says, is that if there's no state budget by May 31st, don't even bother going to the market because it's just not going to be a favorable reception to a public university in Illinois borrowing money if the state once again goes into budget crisis mode.
My guest is Brian Mackey, Illinois Public Radio, a State House reporter. And Brian, to that point, for when we're looking at state universities, the idea of capital bills, as you're saying, that requires a level of trust clearly that hasn't existed in this Rauner administration between Governor Rauner, a Republican, and the Democratic-led State House. What is the mood like this year? We're coming up on an election year. Governor Rauner's actually had leaders meetings. Is there, and maybe not trust, but are the avenues of communication a little bit more open now than they have been in the past?
I mean, I suppose on the surface level, it appears that way. So the governor had this meeting, I guess it was a little more than a week ago now. And arguably that was the governor wanting to appear like a man involved and in charge of this process, right? Famously, he said last fall that, you know, because of House Speaker Michael Madigan's power, he's not in charge and he wants to get to be in charge, but the speaker is blocking him at every turn. Well, that became something that both Democrats and Republicans used against him in the primary election campaign. Well, look, this is a guy who says he's not in charge. I'm a governor who will, or I'm a candidate who would be in charge. So, you know, this is the governor, I think, wanting to project an appearance of being involved in this process when, frankly, he wasn't last year. The budget was resolved in spite of him. As I said, Republicans had to break with him. That was a ground, that was a sort of rank and file welling up from the bottom up. And the speaker went along with it. The governor did not decide to go along with it. And ultimately, it was the, you know, the option that Democrats said was necessary and a lot of Republicans said was necessary, which was raising taxes to spend money. So getting back, there was this leaders meeting. And, you know, the governor is able to say, look, I called the leaders together. I said, here's my demands. We need to have a revenue estimate, which is something that used to be quite common and quite a normal and non-controversial part of the budget process where you get together and agree how much money Illinois expects to collect in taxes and will have to spend. And, you know, the budget needs to be balanced and have no new taxes. And again, I'm not hearing from a lot of people who are eager, at least in government, to raise any additional taxes this year after last year's vote. It is, after all, an election year, and politicians are generally loath to raise taxes in election years. And, you know, whether a budget is balanced, that's something that, you know, there's several different ways you can define a balanced budget, you know, using how, depending on how you account for certain spending and when you account for it. And, you know, so that's something that could continue to be a sticking point as to whether the budget is, you know, whatever passes is actually balanced and whether everyone agrees it is. But I mean, it seems like it should be reasonable enough to make a deal this year.
And Brian, has Governor Rauner produced a balanced budget?
In terms of what he's introduced, I mean, this year was closer than he's been in the past, but his budget plans have always relied on things that were, I guess it's balanced on paper, but very, very, very unlikely to actually happen
in reality.
Yeah, I
should say maybe somewhat speculative things.
Speculative, that's a good way to put it, right? So one would involve
the Thompson Center.
Selling the Thompson Center, that was speculative, but that actually seems more doable because there was at least, you know, bipartisan lip service to
doing
that.
Pension reform would perhaps be another one of
those
speculative.
That's a more challenging one. Although this year, part of the pension reform was not actually counted in the savings, and some Democrats did credit him for that. This is the thing where he says he's going to cut $1 billion in state taxes. That's his talking point. Well, that is, again, it is speculative, but that's not actually needed to balance the budget. Some of the more controversial things he proposed this year are shifting pension costs for teachers away from the state, which currently picks up that cost, onto local school districts, which could result in a huge spike in property taxes as the local schools are forced to absorb that money. The governor says, well, no, we should give them the flexibility, which is another way of saying, you know, allow them to kind of stick it to the teachers' unions in their areas. But Democrats are not going to go along with that. And then he also wants to change health insurance and raise costs for state and university employees. Full disclosure, that includes us as employees.
That's
at the
right.
University of Illinois.
Correct. Both of us are state employees.
Yeah, and would probably pay more in health insurance costs if his plan was going to go through. But that's something that he's fighting with the AFSCME labor union about right now. And Democrats so far have shown no willingness to get involved in that fight.
And what are we hearing from Democrats, in particular from House Speaker Michael Madigan, about what his biggest priority is for the state, both when you look at revenue and spending over this coming fiscal year?
Well, you know, again, no one is really expressing any sort of grand ambitions for new things they'd like to do at this point. It's just like, can we get a budget? The House Speaker put out a sort of, you mentioned that leaders meeting last week, that he put out a very terse statement that came within minutes of his leaving the meeting through a back door, by the way, not speaking to the reporters waiting outside.
Which is pretty typical for Speaker Madigan,
yeah,
you should add.
Fairly typical, although there was a period a couple of years ago where he was having weekly news conferences, but that turned out to be an aberration. Yeah. So he puts out this statement that was not super optimistic and kumbaya-ish. It basically said, you know, as long as the governor is willing to work cooperatively, we can pass a budget. But, you know, he has sought to push his extreme agenda on the backs of the elderly and most vulnerable citizens, yada, yada. Same sort of things we've heard in the past. I guess the big question is, and one of the questions I set out to answer is how, you know, well, will there be another impasse, but also how relevant will the governor be to this process? And that part of that just depends on what the governor thinks is politically most advantageous to him as he's running for reelection. You know, he proposed a budget that spends the money from this tax hike that he's been campaigning and complaining about. And so on the one hand, you think, well, maybe he could sign a budget that uses that money. But on the other hand, maybe it would be better for him to veto whatever budget he gets so he can say, I tried to stand up for you and not, you know, have that the big bad Democrats and their tax increase. Never mind that also a bunch of Republicans voted for it. But, you know, I'm standing up for you. So that, you know, part of these, you know, it's an election year. So these political considerations are certainly going to be a role, play a role in this.
Brian Mackey, as I ask you about the political implications in an election year, an interesting wrinkle yesterday, Senator Sam McCann announcing he's going to be running. He's resigning from his office as a Republican. He's going to be running with the Conservative Party for governor against Governor Rauner. We're going to talk about the political implications of that on Monday's 21st. But I want to just ask you, in the context of budget negotiations, does having another member of the legislature resigning, I mean, I know the numbers sometimes are very important here when it comes down to votes. Do we see that as making a difference in budget negotiations?
I don't think so. And in fact, I think he's actually just resigning from the Republican caucus, not
necessarily
the Senate.
Oh, I see. He's not resigning from office.
So, and frankly, and there are Democrats who kind of have joked with him, you know, off the record and informally, like that he's been voting with the Democrats more than the Republicans on a lot of these things for a long time anyway. So I guess that, you know, I don't know that that will necessarily have much of an effect on the budget negotiations. Frankly, Senator McCann and the governor have been
they've been at odds for some time.
They've been at odds for quite a while.
Safe way to describe that.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, the governor personally not only helped fund an opponent against McCann a couple of years ago, but personally campaigned with a state trooper named Bryce Benton, who is trying to unseat McCann and failed to do so, I should add. And so now McCann is running as a Conservative Party candidate after the governor barely won his primary against a more conservative Republican opponent. So this seems as much, you know, obviously there are complicated reasons that anyone runs for an office involving ego and ambition, but it also seems like certainly is an extension of this feud, spat, whatever you want to call it, between State Senator McCann and Governor Rauner.
And Republicans have also been bringing up the possibility that Democrats want a 6-month budget instead of a year-long budget, again, hinging on the election, with the idea that Democrats, if Democratic candidate J.B. Pritzker were to become governor, would be able to pass a different kind of budget. Have Democrats actually said they want a 6-month budget?
No, this is one of those things that you hear from Republicans, and then when you go talk to actual Democrats, they say, I have no idea what they're talking about. We don't want to do a 6-month budget. And in fact, I went back and checked, you know, some of my archives. I heard this exact same thing in 2014. There were Republicans saying, well, you know, maybe the Democrats will only do a 6-month budget in the last gubernatorial election year. And that turned out not to be the case. Now, they did pass a wildly out of balance budget back in 2014, because remember, that's when the tax increase, or I should say the automatic tax cut, took effect. So they passed money as though Illinois was going to have a lot more money coming in than it did. But you're not hearing from Democrats saying that they want a 6-month budget, assuming, you know, as many Democrats are hopeful that they can retake the governor's office. I don't think they would want to saddle J.B. Pritzker with sort of financial crisis and have to deal with that as he would be coming into office. So it seems like, you know, if you learned any lesson from 2014, it's let's have a full year budget and not have a governor come in into that sort of chaotic situation.
I'm not sure it's going to be a particularly stable situation that our next governor will be coming into, but perhaps less chaotic would be an accurate description. Brian Mackey is Illinois Public Radio's State House reporter, discussing as we're coming a month up now from where a budget should be proposed. Brian, thanks for keeping an eye on this for us. I appreciate it.
Good to talk to you, Nyla.
That does it for us today. We are out of time for this week. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes, Android, wherever you get your podcasts. If you want to follow us on Twitter, our handle's 21stshow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis about what we're talking about. When we're not on air, you can follow us for the latest in Illinois news. If you search for us on Facebook to like us, you can also comment on what we're working on. You can also post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. All those links, every other way to contact us, send us an email, leave us a voicemail. If you want to follow us on social media, don't remember those handles. All you have to remember is our website, 21stshow.org. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music, and special thanks also to our partner, GLT, for being with us this week as we hosted most of our shows from Bloomington Normal. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Have a great weekend.